woke up after that. I saw burning cubes of metal coming out of it at the end, I swear I did. They came down like a shower of meteors, spreading over the vast spaceport like shrapnel. They reached the ground ahead of the ship's tumbling, burning hull. The ingots of hard metal caused 1,000 deafening explosions that knocked everyone off their feet. People ran around screaming. Some threw themselves on the ground. Harris and I? We didn't bother. We knew we were screwed, so we watched the show wearing grim expressions. The burning ship coming right down on top of us, growing impossibly large and loud during the final moments, that was a sight worth remembering. My final thoughts as I died, along with thousands of others, were of my parents. I regretted having brought them anywhere near Legion Varus. If there was ever a bad luck outfit in history, we were it. Bringing my folks out here hadn't been the brightest thing I'd ever done, but it might well have been my last. A burning cube struck the tarmac 100 meters away. The shock wave knocked my dragon flat and I couldn't get it to stand up again. As I died, burning in my dragon's cockpit, I thought about my mama. She'd never get to see her only granddaughter. That was a crying shame. Chapter 4. Eventually, I did manage to catch a revive. As you can imagine, there was quite a backlog of dead people in line ahead of me. Coming back to life is akin to awakening from a dream that won't leave your mind. I could only feel my memories. They were like cobwebs on my face. The past was a veil of hazy unreality. Somehow, when I opened my bleary eyes again, I knew it had been a long while since I'd drawn breath. Don't ask me how I knew, I just did.
"He's breathing," said a female voice I didn't recognize. "What are his scores?"
9.1.
"Good enough, get him off the table."
The first clear image that came in from my retinas was that of an orderly with a few days' stubble on his chin. He gave me a grim smile. "Welcome back, veteran," he said.
"Where am I?"
I croaked, gripping his shoulder for support.
"You're aboard Minotaur. We're in warp. Could you let go for a second? You're bruising my shoulder."
I peered at him and blinked, trying to absorb this information with my newly grown brain. Everything was still a bit fuzzy.
"How long have I been gone?"
I managed. "I don't know. About 10 days, I'd say."
10 days?
I'd been non-existent for 10 days while the universe had marched onward. It wasn't as if I'd slept in a coma. I'd been as dead as a doornail. 10 long days were lost forever in time. It was just this sort of thing that could eat at a legionnaire's mind if you let it. Fortunately, I wasn't the kind of person who dwelled on much of anything. I stood, leg muscles trembling a bit, and slowly staggered toward the equipment lockers. I pulled a smart tunic over my naked, slimy body, and it began to worm its way over my bulk. My clothes were always stretched thinner than those worn by smaller people. It was a natural hazard endured by any man who was 2 meters tall. When I was dressed, I looked for weapons in the locker, but there were none.
"We're not in combat?" I asked.
The unfamiliar bio looked at me. I didn't recognize her, even though she wore the wolf's head patch of Legion Varus. At least I was with my own outfit.
"No," she said. "We're in pursuit of an enemy, however, and we might come out of the warp bubble at any time. You have time to recover, but you should maintain readiness. Those are Turov's orders."
Imperata Turov. Could she be on this ship, too? Great. Only half knowing what was going on, I was able to walk straight by the time I made it to my unit's module. My mind was working again, too. A thought struck me then. A horrible thought. It hit just as I opened the hatch into my module's unit and was met with a chorus of shouted greetings from my comrades. They were all there, Carlos, Kiwi, Natasha, and Leeson. Sargon was polishing a heavy weapons kit, and Della was talking to Harris. She gave me a smile and a nod when I stepped inside. I would have smiled back, but a horror had just been released in my mind. I should have felt glad to see them all again, but I didn't. The thought in my brain, the terrible realization, didn't allow me to have any happiness.
my parents, I said aloud to the assembly. My folks were there at the ceremony. Is there any word?
The enthusiasm of the group dampened immediately. Smiles turned to frowns, and most of them looked down at their work. Della stared at me, troubled. Natasha dropped what she was doing and walked up to me. She looked me in the eye. Every time I faced her lately, I couldn't help but think of her copy back on Dust World. Knowing that Natasha 2.0 was taking care of Etta for Della and I made me feel like I owed her something, too. It was a weird situation, and we all tried to ignore it most of the time, so Natasha wouldn't get in trouble. If the Empire officials ever figured out there were two of her running around, well, one of them would have to be deleted.
I'm sorry, James, she told me sincerely. Everyone in the crowd, they were killed. The whole spaceport was devastated. We lost thousands. Visitors, politicians, reporters, troops, and ship crews. It was a disaster.
It was more than that, I said firmly. It was an attack.
I stared at nothing. My parents were gone. Only military people and rich, important folk got revivals. The rest weren't copied and tracked in the data cores.
You might be right, Natasha said. Our entire unit has been revived over the last 24 hours. We haven't been told much yet, but what the techs are saying privately online, the consensus is the destruction of the freighter was deliberate.
We'd wiped. That's what she was telling me. We'd been standing around on the ground like a bunch of fools holding onto flags and playing martial music while an enemy stalked us and wiped us out.
That's why we're flying now, isn't it? I asked. Who are we following? The Saurians?
She shook her head.
I don't know yet. Centurion Graves will tell us more soon. He's with Imperator Turov in the Tribune now, getting the details. He'll brief us after that.
I wanted to put my face in my hands, but I didn't. Everyone was watching, and I was a veteran now, a man who wasn't allowed to feel anything when faced with a loss. Mentally, I corrected that thought as soon as I had it. I was allowed one emotion. Rage. I could safely apply that to any enemy at any time.
Well, I said grimly, when we catch up with them, they'll rue the day they came to Earth's skies, whether they turn out to be squids, lizards, or something else entirely.
The group gave me a ragged cheer, and I moved to my equipment locker. Veteran Harris and Della came up behind me.
Yes? I asked, trying to stay civil. In the past, Harris and I had rarely seen eye to eye.
Harris cleared his throat uncomfortably.
I wanted to express my sympathies, McGill, he said.
I looked at him. I didn't think a few civvy deaths could faze an old soldier like you.
Well, we're talking about family. Family's different. And getting permed while attending a parade isn't the same thing as a legionnaire dying on the battlefield. What happened back on Earth was wrong. But we'll put this right when we catch them, whoever they are.
I nodded and watched him walk away. When he left, Della stepped close and put her arms around my neck. She had to reach really high to do that, standing on her tiptoes. She put her cheek against my chest and didn't say anything. Awkwardly, I patted her on the back. Then she hugged me and walked away. That was it. Grieving, done Dust Worlder style. At least she'd understood I'd suffered a loss, as had our daughter Etta, who would never meet her grandparents now. I spent the rest of the day drilling my squad, but not in their dragons because we didn't have any aboard Minotaur. That was a surprise, a bad one. Primus Winslade's auxiliary cavalry cohort had attached to Legion Varus. We'd been riding the best cavalry units we had left in the parade, but they'd naturally been destroyed, along with our bodies. The spare units, the most battered dragons in the Legion, had been sent back to Dust World for servicing before our next mission assignment. The long and short of it was that we'd been reduced to an infantry cohort once again. Disappointed but no less determined to find those who had permed my family, I readied my troops as heavy infantry. Someone had scared up enough breastplates and exoskeletons for that. At least we aren't down to running around in our panties with snap rifles, Carlo said. Sorry about your parents, big guy.
Thanks.
You think it was the lizards? I think they hate us the most. Or maybe it was the squids, hard to tell.
That's right. It's hard to tell.
My flat, expressionless answers got through to Carlos. Even he could tell I just wasn't in the mood for banter. He offered me a hit on a flask he had in his locker against regs, but I passed. I was too upset to drink. It would rip up my fresh-grown guts right now, and I wanted to stay sharp for the briefing. My tapper beeped about half hour into the exercise regimen, and my people sighed in relief. They seemed to think I'd been working them hard right after a revive, but I didn't care. We had to be ready for anything. That was my new motto. The message on my tapper was from Centurion Graves. I'd been summoned to his office. I put my squad on break and left them breathing hard with their backs on the deck. None of them had complained, but they were more than ready for old McGill to take a hike. When I reached Graves' office, I honestly expected the other adjunct officers and non-coms to be there. But they weren't. We met alone in his stark chamber. Graves' office had always been neat and dimly lit. Today was no exception. Unlike other officers, he didn't adorn his workplace with pictures of comrades, defeated aliens, soothing forest hollows, or anything else. There were only four steel walls, a big computer desk, and Graves sitting ramrod straight in the middle of the room. He stood up as I entered and gestured toward his desk. He'd cleared it of computer scrolls and had a starscape displayed from edge to edge.
I thought you might have a particular interest in our destination this time out.
You'd be correct on that assumption, Centurion.
Graves nodded. He tapped his desk and the image shimmered in response.
This is Sol, ringed in green. 30 lights out toward the core is Zeta Herculis, Dust World. See this new green addition? That's Machine World, circling Gamma Pavonis.
I followed along easily enough. As a star traveler, I had had occasion to consult maps of the systems I traversed. Within the vast region of space known as Frontier 921, there were thousands of star systems, most of which were uninhabited. The 100-odd systems that did support life had all been subjugated by the Galactic Empire. But Graves' map showed more than that. He scrolled a little and zoomed out. A blue line appeared, then a red one. The two met in places, but not along a perfectly smooth border. Machine World was in one of those gray areas, right between the outer limits of the Empire and the red-lined territory, which I already knew delineated the cephalopod kingdom.
This map, I said, eyeing it with growing interest, this is the best star map I've ever seen, sir. Have the Magua finally supplied us with better intel?
Hardly, Graves said. This is our own creation. This comes straight from Central. They've got a few thousand eggheads working on stuff like this down there for once they've earned their paychecks.
I had to agree. I leaned over and my hands touched the edge of the desk. The screen rippled where I touched it, but didn't change, as I was careful not to give it any gestures it might take as a command. I thought the squids only had 300 stars, I commented. There must be a few thousand inside that red squiggly line.
That's right. Over 2,000 stars are inside their territory, in fact. But you have to remember that they said they had 300 worlds, not star systems. They meant inhabited colonies and conquered planets, not just sterile rocks in space.
I nodded thoughtfully. The cephalopod kingdom was dwarfed by the Empire. Even Frontier 921 by itself was larger than the squid's entire region of home space. But all the same, when compared to them, Earth's three occupied worlds were a joke.
Sir, I said, this is intensely interesting, but could you get to the part displaying our target world? I want to know who we're about to exterminate.
Graves looked at me for a second.
I understand you had a private loss back on Earth.
That's right, sir. My family was in the audience.
I don't want to give a man false hopes,
Graves said.
It's very unlikely anyone in the audience survived. As far as we can tell, those people were all permed.
I frowned. That's what I figured. Is there any way to confirm who's among the dead? He shook his head.
Not now. We're in a warp bubble, and even when we come out of it, we won't be using the deep link to talk to Earth. We're off the grid on this one. Communications blackout. You'll have to wait until we get back home.
Slowly, I nodded my head. Let's talk about the enemy, then. Who did this, sir? I looked at him with hungry eyes, but he shook his head.
We honestly don't know the exact nature of the enemy. All we can do is follow this line into space.
A white line appeared cutting across home space. One end started at Earth and the other headed toward the red region on the map, cephalopod space.
The squids, I said. I knew it. We don't know that for sure,
Graves said.
Not yet. Look at the angle of attack, for example. If it was a deep thrust assault from the squids, why didn't they head directly back toward their territory?
I looked and I saw he had a point. The line we were following didn't go straight from Earth to the border and then on into squid space. It cut off at about a 45-degree angle. I'm sure the techs have been working hard, I said. But how do we even know we're on the right path?
We're not 100% on that. Here's what happened. The freighter was hit by weapons fire after it came out of warp, indicating a ship had followed it. We received distress calls, and the word came down that they'd been boarded.
Boarded? I asked in alarm. By who?
We don't know. Alien invaders of some kind. The freighter crew was knocked out almost immediately. The one thing we do know is that shortly after they came out of warp, they were attacked. A significant portion of the titanium cargo was stolen. The ship kept following its original course, but without pilots, it struck the atmosphere and blew up over the spaceport.
Right. How did we get a trace on the enemy ship?
The second warp signature was detected. The attackers went back into warp and slipped away. By definition, a warp bubble moves faster than light and is hard to trace. We were fortunate enough to get a course heading from sensors in its path after it had already left our system. We couldn't see where they were at the moment, but we could see where they had been as the light of their bubble moved away from Earth.
I see. So we extrapolated their course and attempted to follow. How many ships are in pursuit?
Just Minotaur. She was the only dreadnought on station over the spaceport, so she responded immediately. She didn't have any troops aboard. We were all dead on the ground. But Nagata figured we could revive the Legion on the run. No one else could load up and move out faster, so Varys got the assignment.
I nodded again, unsurprised. Legion Varys had never been blessed with luck. It sounds to me like we're chasing ghosts, sir, I said. The enemy could come out of warp anywhere, change course, and we'd never know it while we're in warp.
We've thought of that. We're coming out now and then, checking data and continuing. So far, we've seen no evidence indicating they've deviated from their original path.
Frowning, I looked at the white line on the map. So where are they going?
Three systems loosely intersect this course. None of these harbor noteworthy civilizations.
Are the stars in squid space?
No. All the stars the course intersects are within the borders of Frontier 921.
Scratching my head, I stared at the data. Graves had three golden circles around star systems that were strung along our course. None of them held worlds of significance. It doesn't make much sense, does it? I asked. If they are squids, why aren't they running to an occupied squid world? If they're not squids, why aren't they going to an inhabited world like Cancri 9?
That's a puzzle, and we're working on it. But that's about all the time I have to chat, McGill. Return to your squad and carry on.
I hesitated before I left. Sir, may I ask why you gave me this private briefing?
Two reasons,
Graves answered.
One, I wanted to know how you were taking your loss. I'm impressed. You don't seem to be broken or irrational. You're pissed and ready for blood, sure, but that's more than acceptable.
And the other reason?
I thought you deserved it.
The rest of the troops will be getting the boiled-down version. This new intel, the star charts, and the exact position of the squid worlds, that won't be common knowledge. Some of these details are technically illegal, in fact. Any NERB would designate maps of stars beyond our provincial borders as classified, need-to-know data. But I knew you would be interested. And hell, you and your friends helped give us much of it.
I perked up at that. The data globe. The one Carlos and Kiwi discovered in the squid tunnels back on Machine World. You got this intel from that find, didn't you?
He nodded. Another secret for you to keep locked inside that thick skull of yours.
It's in the vault, sir.
Good. Dismissed, veteran.
I left Graves' office with a lot to think about. I didn't exactly feel better, but I didn't feel worse either. I figured I had to accept that my parents were permed. They'd never had themselves copied onto a data disk. That was only for military and government people. Like most of humanity, my folks were privileged in that they would only have to die once for their species.
Chapter 5. Over the next week, our first destination star grew bigger and brighter by the hour. Our course didn't intersect it precisely. We had to deviate a few billion kilometers to reach the system itself. But that didn't mean it wasn't a hit. The raiders could have made a course adjustment. They could have been careless, in a hurry, or purposefully deceptive. Whatever the case, the brass figured they couldn't afford to skip this possible destination. If we slid on by, staying in our warp bubble, while they were hiding in this lonely system, we'd never find them again. As far as I knew, following a ship that's traveling in an Alcubierre Drive warp bubble had never been done before by Earthlings. We were very new to space combat. Among the core systems where a civil war still raged to this day, I could only surmise that alien captains were old hands at techniques like this. But humans were comparative rubes out on the frontier. For us, it was all new. Knowing it was my commander's first time out didn't make matters any easier for me. Second-guessing their decisions was driving me crazy. I wished I could hound them up on Gold Deck. I wanted to be there watching every instrument, privy to every briefing. I burned to find these raiders. They had to die. We came out of warp near the target star, already on high alert. For all we knew, the enemy had the capacity to trace us as we chased after them. There was some evidence to support this. They'd caught our freighter handily enough. Fully armed and standing ready in the lifters for a hot drop, my people were tense but professional. The troops in my squad watched me closely and followed my lead. None of them were smiling or carrying on like Harris's people were. Instead, they were grim-faced, just like I was. The star was an M-class red dwarf. In our stellar neighborhood, about three-quarters of the stars were red dwarfs. It was the dimmest kind of star known that still burned. There were planets around the target star, but they were cold rocks. Nothing to write home about. Still, if I were trying to set up a secret base, why not here? No one would care to do more than survey the place once and move on. It wouldn't be comfortable, but it would be safe. We scanned and cruised around like a prowling shark for just over 30 hours. The wait was intolerable for me. I didn't sleep until the all-clear was sounded by the brass. My squad mates smiled until I hammered my fist in frustration on a bulkhead. They stopped smiling after that, and I left the module to take a walk. For them, the all-clear meant no fighting, no dying. For me, it meant no closure. No chance for revenge on Earth's attackers. I felt the ship lurch back into warp again. We'd wasted our precious time, and now there were only 2 stars left on our projected course. In my mind, our odds of catching the raiders, or even properly identifying them, had just dropped by 1/3. My troops sensed a darkness in me, and most of them kept their distance over the following days. Even Della didn't seem to know what to say to me. She wasn't in my squad, but she was in the same platoon. She gave me sympathetic nods, but no comforting touches. I could have used a few touches, but she'd never been the nurturing type. Natasha was different. She seemed more concerned than ever about my well-being. Of the entire squad, whom I had drilled for 12 hours out of every shipboard cycle of 24, she alone kept trying to reach me on an emotional level. Unfortunately, she did this by scolding as often as not.
James,
she said after we'd finished yet another obstacle run on green deck,
don't you think you're working them too hard?
No.
But everyone in the squad is...
Listen, I said. I'm done with half-assing around during my training sessions. This squad has grown soft since we left Machine World. In my opinion, it started even before that, back when we began riding dragons instead of walking. Did you see how Centurion Belter's crew could run up a mountain all day in their full kit? That's how we should look. We're heavy infantry now, not saddled-up aristocrats with our butts high and dry inside a dragon. She nodded, pursing her lips.
You have a good point. We're out of practice playing the part of infantry, but do you think Harris is a sloppy veteran?
What's that got to do with it?
He's not drilling his people to death, James. He's doing no more than 5 hours of physical stuff and marksmanship for 3 more. That's the norm, right?
Despite my good feelings toward her, Natasha was now beginning to piss me off. After all, I outranked her. But this conflict ran deeper than rank. She'd always been something of a mother hen to me, and sometimes I think she still believed it was her job to play the part of my conscience. You give me an idea, I said. Thanks, Specialist.
My pleasure, Vet,
she said, her voice surprised and confused. I could tell she had no idea what I was planning. I strode purposefully off green deck. I could feel her eyes on my back. My first move was to okay the idea with Adjunct Leeson. He gave me a dirty chuckle when I described my proposal. That's great, McGill, he said. I didn't think you had it in you. Approve. Give him hell. My plan was thus set into motion. I didn't warn anyone about what was coming. Instead, just after lunch, I jogged my team up to green deck again. They groaned but followed me gamely enough. They'd toughened up over the last few weeks. Harris was there as I knew he would be. He was using low-powered laser target rifles, having his troops nail moving targets. I marched up and stood behind him until he finished coaching a trooper on adjusting her sights. McGill, he asked in surprise, what do you want? We have this turf until 1400 hours. Get lost. Can't do that, Vet, I said. I'm here to issue a challenge. Frowning fiercely, Harris watched me remove a gauntlet and throw it on the ground at his feet. He put his hands on his hips instead of picking it up, however. What the hell? Have you lost your mind, boy? It's approved, Vet, I said. Adjunct Leeson thinks it's a great idea. He would. Harris broke off, and he couldn't help but glance around himself. My squad, panting from their run, had come up behind me and stood with grim looks on their faces. Harris's own people had stopped shooting and were walking up to see what was going on. Everyone soon caught sight of the gauntlet on the ground, and they knew what that meant. Since ancient times, a challenge was a challenge. Harris couldn't refuse to pick up the gauntlet unless he wanted to look like a coward. He scooped up my gauntlet with an angry flourish and threw it into my chest. I caught it and slipped it back on again. All right, he said. Have it your way, kid. As the challenged, I choose the ground and the rules. I choose the mud pit, with knives, nothing else. I blinked. That hadn't been part of my plan. I'd envisioned a straight-up shooting contest. Most Varus full-contact exercises went that way. We were accustomed to stalking one another in the rugged greenery playing Capture the Flag or Last Man Standing. Usually, scores were kept with automated equipment that incapacitated dead soldiers. But this time, it was going to be for real. Knives? I asked. Part of me began to question the wisdom of my challenge, but it was too late for regrets now. You chicken? Harris demanded angrily. Nope. We accept. When do we go? How about right fucking now, farm boy? That was it. Negotiations had been concluded. Both squads began to hoot and rip off their clothes. We walked in two loose knots toward the mud pit, which was located in the swampiest corner of Green Deck. The mud pit was about 40 meters across and 1 meter deep at the center.
In the deep section in the middle of the pit, every step a man took threatened to suck off his shoes. The effort was quickly exhausting. "Strip down to your shorts," I ordered my squatties. "No tops. Don't give them anything to hold on to, and try to stay out of the center of the pit." My team shed their clothes and soon stood in camo shorts. They looked nervous, but game. I felt a surge of pride at that and also a pang of remorse. Not all of them would make it out of this alive. Their willingness to die at my orders gave me pause. Was my personal anger at the universe worthy of the pain and sacrifice they were about to experience? As soon as these debilitating thoughts entered my head, I did my best to push them away. They wouldn't help me now. We were committed. Honor had to be served, and the best thing I could do for my squad was lead them to victory. Lining up on the shore, both squads stood with knives drawn. Some were snarling. Some were staring with determined expressions. Experienced Varus Legionnaires aren't like normal folk. We're killers. Everyone present had died at least a dozen times, and we'd killed many times our weight in enemies. There's something different about a soldier who's seen so much death, but you can't understand the difference until you've seen an experienced Legionnaire face combat. Sure, we knew we'd catch a revive when this was over, but that didn't mean shit to our bodies or our minds. A revive was a copy, nothing more. This flesh we stood in right now, that was going to be torn up and spit out. That's what mattered to us, and we knew it was all too real. Our guts and our minds were churning. Before we started, I noticed there were drones floating overhead. A few knots of officers and troops from other units had come out to watch in person as well. Word had traveled fast. We were about to put on a show, and I had the feeling the entire complement of Minotaur would be watching tonight. Harris lifted his blade. It glittered, catched the gleam of a passing star that shone through the dome above. The heavens were displayed on that dome along with an added artificial sun that matched the one nearest to us in actual space. It was like standing in pale daylight, even though it was an illusion. Harris held his blade higher, urging me to get started. I looked over my troops. They were breathing hard and wearing grim expressions. Most of them were splashing mud over their bodies to provide less grip for our opponents. The women were bare-breasted, but nobody gave a damn about that now. We were about to fight to the death. None of them needed encouragement or correction from me, so I turned back to face my enemy. That's what Harris and his crew were now. The enemy. My knife rose into the air, matching Harris's blade and signaling we were ready. A roar left my throat and I sprang into the mud leading the charge. The opposing squad rushed to meet us, legs pumping up and down, brown muck flying high. It was on. Chapter 6. Despite my orders to the rest of my squad, I moved to the middle of the mud. You see, I'm an extremely tall man. That meant that while the mud came to a short person's waist, it only went to just above my knees, giving me a distinct advantage in mobility. I honestly expected to see Harris rush into the center and meet me, but he didn't. Instead, he sprinted around the rim where it was just deep enough to get his ankles sloppy. He went for my weakest fighters, the ones that were hanging back uncertainly. Harris wanted to teach me a lesson. I realized that about 10 seconds into the fight. He was a masterful warrior, but that didn't mean he liked to die. He'd deliberately chosen a grim scenario, one sure to result in horrible moments. He'd also chosen a setup that would play to his own personal strengths. He liked knives and hand-to-hand combat because he was deadly in close. Harris met Gorman near the edge of the circular pool of mud, and Gorman went down after 3 cuts. Harris moved away with a bloody line across his chest, but nothing more. Gorman was flopping and shivering in mud at his feet, trying to make it to the edge of the pit. If he could climb out under his own power, well, he might live. Harris danced past him and moved on to the next closest opponent, Keevy. She gave him a harder time, but he put her down pretty fast, too. Crippled and making a lot of noise, she crawled for the edge, holding in her guts with one hand. In the middle of the pit, I had my own problems. Seeing me isolated, three of Harris's fighters rushed as a team to meet me. I stood my ground, ready. Fighting with knives is different than fighting with swords or clubs, especially when you're stuck in mud. Reach is a critical factor. Although the three men who came at me tried to time it so they hit me at the same moment, one of them slipped and fell behind his two charging comrades. The other two, well, they didn't have the reach I did, and they couldn't move their mired feet as fast either. With my arm outstretched to its maximum length, I planted my knife in the neck of the leader. His eyes bulged and he tried to get to me, even though he was dead on his feet. I applauded the effort, but retreated and let him die face down with bubbles farting up around his grimy head. The second man came in before I could retreat and managed to score. He got a shot into my ribs. But there's a reason why we have ribs. They're built to deflect weapons and teeth from our inner organs. I was hurt, but the thrust hadn't punched deep. He had his arms wrapped around me, and we did the bear hug thing, struggling to keep on our feet and roaring. In return for the blade in my side, I brought mine down two-handed, driving it into the shorter man's skull. His eyes rolled up and he slipped away bonelessly into the muck. The third man, the one who'd slipped while charging with his two fellows, couldn't help but notice I'd nailed both his wingmen and was still standing tall. He turned and slogged away as quickly as he could. I didn't blame him. Instead of following the runner, I moved to meet Harris at the edge of the pit, where he was now sparring with Carlos. Whatever else Carlos might be, he's not a slouch when it comes to a hard fight. The two of them were in a clinch, each holding on to each other's knife hand and straining. Carlos couldn't hope to win the struggle. Harris was bound to overpower him in the end, despite the fact he was bleeding now from a few wounds of his own. What Carlos needed was a quick rescue, and I came up on the two of them from behind, planning on an easy kill. Harris didn't give it to me. He got his foot hooked behind Carlos's ankle and sent him down on his back. A quick stoop, thrust, and Carlos was out. I tried to slosh my way up to Harris before he could turn back around, but he must have heard me coming. He spun around and grinned with blood in his mouth. "Why are we always meeting up like this, McGill?" "At least this time it was my idea," I replied.
"See you in hell, boy,"
he shouted, and threw his knife at me. It was a surprise move and expertly executed. The blade flipped once and drove right toward my chest. Our knives are sharper than simple steel, and I knew that if that point hit dead on with that much force, I was going to be taken down. Twisting with all the speed I had left in me, I took it in the shoulder. My right arm was numb after that, but I managed to grip my knife in my left. Advancing, it was my turn to grin. Harris had disarmed himself. But Harris didn't miss a beat. He stooped and grabbed Carlos's knife out of his dead hand. How had he managed to find it in an instant under a foot of mud? I don't know, but I'd always thought Harris was a man who could fight like the devil himself. Around us, the wild roars and screams of battle had died down. Many of the combatants on both sides were dead or too injured to continue. Most of the survivors were busy dragging themselves out of the mud pit. Only a few were still in the game. Harris and I slashed and circled, shuffling awkwardly in the mud. I kept backing up, drawing him toward the deep section, which had been my original plan. To some degree, it worked. He snarled and fought to take me down quickly with lunges and thrusts, but I stayed in the fight. My right arm hung, almost useless. My left was bleeding, too, having picked up a slash somewhere along the line.
"You're the one who will bleed out this time," Harris said, grinning at me.
He was right, but I didn't bother to reply. The last time we'd fought with knives, he'd had the upper hand, but he'd lost too much blood and passed out. This time, it looked like I would suffer the same fate. But I had a plan of sorts. I kept retreating, drawing him into the deepest mud. He followed with a greedy light in his eye. He wanted to see me fall. When I figured it couldn't get any deeper, I made my play. I reversed myself and came on hard, making wide, sweeping slashes. My arms are longer than an ape's, according to every schoolmate I'd ever scuffled with, and those slashes were hard to avoid. Now, you have to understand something about Harris. He doesn't like to get hurt. He likes to win as cleanly as he can. His first instinct, therefore, was to fall back before my onslaught and look for an opening to dart into and finish me. When he took his first backpedaling step, the sucking mud pulled at his legs, locking him in, slowing him down. I switched tactics again, stopping the slashes. I made an all-out lunge while he was off balance, and I saw the shock in his eyes. I'd planted my blade in his chest, stopping his heart. Even so, he got his knife around to stab me in the back. The move opened me up, but didn't quite put me down. Harris sank, slowly. Roaring and grinning, I lifted my knife and whirled around looking for fresh challengers. At first, I thought there wasn't anyone left. About half the combatants were dead and floating. Most of the rest were lying on the shore around the pit, struggling to breathe. Bio people had shown up from somewhere. They were like vultures when anyone died. They were tending to those who could easily be patched up and hauling the rest away to the recycling center. Then I spotted a figure. She was relatively near, but I hadn't noticed her because she was as motionless as a tiger in tall grass. It was Della. My heart sank, and I felt a little sick. In my rage and frustration, I'd forgotten that she was part of Harris's squad. She came toward me, realizing she'd been spotted. She watched me with predatory eyes and moved like a cat stalking prey. Somehow, even bare-breasted and covered in filth, she still managed to look graceful. I let her approach. I didn't move except to follow her as she came close and began to circle. She stepped around me carefully, and I thought she might throw her weapon the way Harris did, but she didn't. She gazed up to me with deadly serious eyes. Tossing my weapon aside to the edge of the pit, I stood still. She followed my knife with darting eyes. She looked at me in puzzlement and cocked her head. Stepping close, warily, she dared to speak.
"What are you doing? Everyone is watching. Thousands of eyes are on us."
"I don't care. I can't kill the mother of my own child." She licked her lips and stalked closer. I stood watching her, wondering what she'd do.
"You're dishonoring both of us,"
she hissed. "Why don't you just kill me then?" I asked her. "Are you afraid?" Della kept her eyes on my hands, flicking her gaze from one to the other. I could tell she didn't trust me at all. This wasn't our first fight, you have to understand.
"A little," she said. "But the real problem is, I don't want to kill you either. Why did you start this stupid fight? What was the purpose?"
I heaved a sigh. "I don't know. When we came to that first star system, I was so ready to catch the raiders and kill them. I wanted blood. I guess I started this out of frustration."
"A stupid move. I should kill you just for that."
She came at me then, but her arms moved slowly. It was only a fractional difference, but I could see it. A play thrust, not even on target. I caught her wrist and pulled her off balance. A moment later, I had my knee on her back and her knife hand stretched out away from both our bodies.
"Yield,"
I said.
"I will not,"
she said angrily.
"You won't? Wasn't that what you wanted?" "I won't," she hissed. "Not unless you admit I could have killed you."
I laughed.
"All right, I admit it. I'm as good as dead on my feet. Happy?" "Not at all. But I yield."
Getting an arm under her waist, I straightened and tossed her onto dry land. She landed on her feet and dropped her knife in the blood-soaked dirt. The mud pit battle was over. I walked warily to the bio people who clucked their tongues and sprayed me with cleansers and new skin. Della returned to her own squad, and I looked after her thoughtfully. She'd never passed up a solid opportunity to kill me before. People congratulated me on the victory and even cheered me. I didn't feel like I deserved their praise, however. I felt spent and almost as frustrated as I'd been when I'd started this mission. A few hours later, Graves summoned me to his Stark office again. I went with my arm in a sling and my left eye swollen almost shut. He wasn't smiling, and he didn't congratulate me when I got there. I stood at attention until he told me what he wanted.
At ease, veteran,
Graves said at last. He walked toward me and looked me over.
You're in sorry shape.
Nothing a few layers of fresh cells won't cure, sir.
I don't mean your body. I'm talking about your mind. I thought you'd take your losses in stride, but I was wrong. You let your emotions make your decisions for you today.
I didn't say anything. We both knew he was right.
Well, Graves said, despite its questionable effects on morale, it was an effective training exercise. Mud pit fights to the death, that's the sort of thing we usually reserve for recruits and candidates seeking promotion. Let's not have a fresh challenge from you next week, clear?
Clear. Nothing like this will ever happen again, sir.
I don't believe that for a second.
Again, I said nothing. I don't like to lie without a good reason. Heaving a sigh, Graves returned to his desk.
Here's something that might cheer you up. We've decided to pass up the second star system we're targeting. The techs have run all the numbers. They think the second star, a binary system, is very unlikely to be the Raiders' base. Odds are we'll find them at the last star in the line, which is right at the squid border.
He had my interest now. I shuffled to his desk, where he had displayed the local stars. I tapped to the binary system we were supposed to pass by. It had the generic name of L-374. It contained an orange-colored K-class star circled by a smaller M-class companion. The last star in the line, the one we were to visit next, was yet another of the ubiquitous red dwarfs.
Sir, I asked, we're really going to skip this orange star? Why?
Why skip L-374? Because Gold Deck says so. Remember, veteran, I'm not in command of this expedition, and neither are you.
But what if we don't find them in the third system? What will we do then? If we have to backtrack to the K-class, they might have had time to slip away.
Graves shook his head.
We won't bother. If I had to guess, I'd say we'll check the last system and give up. Turov will turn us around and head home again after that.
She'd give up? She'd actually be willing to go back to Earth empty-handed?
He shrugged. What else would you suggest?
I think we should keep searching until we find them, I boomed, letting my voice rise more than I'd meant to. There has to be a fourth star somewhere along this line, somewhere else to look.
Graves studied me for a moment before speaking.
If you kept following this course, which we don't know is the correct one anyway, you'd enter enemy space. After passing through the entirety of the cephalopod kingdom, we'd come out on the other side near the core of the Perseus arm. There, we'd find another star to check.
Is that far, huh?
I asked in disappointment. He put two fingers on his desktop and brought them slowly together. The map contracted. I could now see the line extended farther out. There was a fourth star, but it was pretty distant.
Miguel,
Graves said,
I want you to give this up if we don't find them soon. It's not healthy, and worse, it's pointless. Use your brain, man. What are the odds the Raiders came from so far out? We're talking about more than 170 lights from Earth to get to that fourth star. It doesn't even make sense that an enemy would know about a freighter heading to Earth from Machine World at that distance.
Brooding and quiet, I stopped asking questions, and Graves soon dismissed me. Frustrated and feeling like my greatest fears concerning this expedition were coming to life before my eyes, I left his office. I hadn't wanted this to turn into a wild goose chase, but that's exactly what was happening. I could feel it. There was only one other place to go, only one other person to talk to who could change things. With a heavy sigh, I headed for Gold Deck. Chapter 7 Imperator Turov wasn't always the easiest officer to talk to. First off, she liked to put barriers in a man's way. Secondly, she was always busy doing something important, or at least something that seemed important. Today was no exception to either of these rules. There were no less than three adjuncts and a couple of centurions that I had to go through to meet up with Turov.
The high and mighty one herself didn't have time for a lowly non-com, I was told this repeatedly. Insisting I had something to say that only Turov herself was qualified to listen to got me pretty far, but that was only because they knew I'd had unusual dealings with her in the past. Eventually I was faced with a final adjunct, a woman named Bakchan. She had an attitude as snotty as the rest of them. I told her my story all over again, concluding that Turov wouldn't like it if an adjunct turned me back. At last, she led me to a well-appointed office door. It wasn't the same office where I'd met up with Turov in the past, but I figured maybe she'd moved. The lock buzzed open even before my fist rapped on the door. It melted away from my hand as I pushed it open. Stepping inside, I was met with another unpleasant surprise. I was standing in Winslade's office, not Turov's. He was sitting behind his desk with his non-reg jack boots resting between a monitor and a cup of coffee. Working on a computer scroll, he waved at me with a skinny set of fingers, indicating I should approach but remain standing. I did so, but after a moment I couldn't take the waiting around. "Sir? Primus, sir, I'm sorry. I must have been led to the wrong office. I'll be going now. Didn't mean to bother you." Winslade glanced up and gave me an unhappy stare.
"You're in the right place, McGill," he said. "That is, if it can be said that there is a right place for the likes of you."
"I don't understand, sir." He set the scroll aside and removed his feet from the desk. Weaving together his fingers like a spider web, he leaned forward and gave me an unfriendly appraisal. I could tell I was a bug on a dinner plate to him.
"Let me spell it out for you," he began. "I'm in command of your cohort. In truth, even I'm too far up the chain of command to be talking to the likes of a freshly promoted veteran, and the Imperator is two steps above my station. The idea that you should be allowed to waltz in here and meet with her in person on demand, it's preposterous, and it's going to stop today. If you have something to say to the Imperator, you'll tell me first. If I find it worthy, I may kick it up another level, but I'll warn you right now that's highly unlikely."
Winslade had my attention now. I knew he didn't like me, and he didn't enjoy it when I went over his head and talked to Turov, but this wasn't about protocol or personal dislike. He wanted to know what I was up to. He didn't want to be cut out of the loop, as had happened in the past. "I heard you, Primus, loud and clear. I'll be going now." I spun on my heel and managed to take two long strides across his thick carpet toward the door before he reacted.
"Halt! You haven't been dismissed, veteran."
Stopping, I spun back around, but I still didn't say anything. I stood at attention and looked at the wall.
"Tell me why you wanted to talk to the Imperator," he prompted.
"Because I think she's making a strategic error, sir." A frown grew on his face. It was a wary look of displeasure.
"You've always believed you know better than your commanders how to run our legions, haven't you?"
"Not at all, sir. But sometimes people don't have a clear view. They don't have the vision of the man in the trenches."
"Interesting. Let me see if I can interpret your vague hints. You've uncovered a scheme of some kind. You believe the Imperator should be given this information in person, as it may affect her decisions regarding our current mission."
I gave him a startled glance. I didn't have any such information. I was planning on trying to convince her not to give up on finding the raiders too easily, that was all. But as usual, Winslade, with his conniving personality, thought I was holding back something more sinister.
"Aha!" Winslade cried, banging a skinny fist on his desk. "I've got your attention now, don't I? Yes, McGill, even I can follow your clever machinations. Well, I'll have none of it. I don't want you pestering Turov. I've given the staff orders to intercede if you try. As you can see, they've been quite effective today."
Nodding and looking back at the wall, I paused for a second. "Am I dismissed then, sir?"
"No, you're not dismissed."
He studied me quietly for a few seconds.
He was obviously waiting for me to volunteer information. I endeavored to make my face a blank mask and said nothing.
"Damn you, man," he said at last. "You're not getting out of here without telling me what this is about. But even if you don't want to talk, your motivations should be vulnerable to logical reasoning. Let's continue extrapolating down this path. If you wanted to tell Turov something crucial, why not send her a text? Can it be because you're well aware all your texts are carefully monitored?"
I gave him another startled look. He smiled.
"I see you do know. That indicates you want to talk to Turov in person in order to give her a private message. And don't even try to convince me you're simply making another ham-handed romantic overture. I know that you've been far from lonely at night."
This entire discussion was getting off track in an alarming way. Winslade seemed to have gone paranoid, reading my texts, having people provide him with reports on my dating life. The man was losing it.
"Sir, I'm in the dark about all that," I said, honestly. "I'm just trying to help our commander achieve her goals. If you stand between me and the Imperator, well, that's your business, but I wouldn't recommend it."
Winslade was suddenly pissed again. He stood up and began to pace. He clasped his arms behind his back oddly, with one hand grabbing the elbow of the other.
"Threats! You dare so much! You think you still have her ear and her eye, don't you? All right, McGill. You can go to the Imperator and give her your dirty little report. But don't think I'm not watching. Don't think I'll allow you to keep rank-climbing and undermining my position year after year. I have real rank, and I have a growing record in the field. On top of that, let's not forget I'm still in your chain of command. I can make things unpleasant for you."
"Of course, sir. I must say it's been a pleasure to serve. Can I be on my way now?"
"Get out."
I'd been thrown out of any number of offices, so I knew the routine. I left without saying anything more. I didn't even glance back to see what he was doing. When the door squeezed shut behind me, I met up with the sneering adjunct Bakchan. She'd evidently been waiting for me.
"I'll take you back to your module, veteran," Bakchan said. "This way, please."
You might want to check with Primus Winslade on that point first."
Frowning, she looked at her tapper, which beeped and displayed fresh orders. She looked up at me a moment later, startled.
"I'm to take you to the Imperator?"
"Yes, as I originally requested."
Adjunct Bakchan didn't say another word as she marched me down a passage or two. We wound up in front of a pair of imposing doors. She looked more worried than annoyed now. When Turov was involved directly, she knew enough to stay quiet and keep her head low. The office doors that led to Turov's office were impressive indeed. They weren't like any I'd seen on a dreadnought before. Ornately carved with dark alien hardwoods, they depicted the heads of what looked like a species of bird that had been crossed with a demon. I stepped inside, and the first thing I noticed was the carpet. It wasn't your typical military-grade weatherproof stuff. It was sumptuous, red, rich. It felt like I was walking on velvet.
"What do you think of my new office, McGill?"
asked a voice I recognized. I looked for Turov, but I didn't see her right off. There were hanging curtains, folding glass barriers, and a variety of other decorations all over the place.
"Wow," I said. "This is really something, sir."
Imperator Galina Turov became visible then. Sort of. She was lurking behind a semi-opaque pane of glass. I couldn't help but stare as her lithe form was displayed in stark silhouette. What's more, it looked to me like she was walking around nude back there. She seemed to be toweling off her hair like she'd just come out of the shower. It took me a long second, but I finally realized this personal display couldn't be an accident. No one put a light bulb behind their shower curtain and stood between the two without a damned good reason.
"Sir?" I asked.
Should I come back another time?
Will your visits be any less annoying if it is postponed?
I'm not sure I can promise that.
Then let's get this over with. Take a seat, James.
James? She usually didn't call me that. She only did so, in fact, when she was in an amorous mood or drunk. You have to understand that I'd had an inappropriate relationship with the Imperator some years back,